From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's look at the tea leaves after last night's election results. Yesterday, Virginians elected the Democrat Terry McAuliffe to be their new governor, a narrow win over Tea Party candidate Ken Cuccinelli. The Republican Chris Christie won re-election in a landslide in New Jersey. Many cities elected new mayors, including New York, where Bill de Blasio will become the city's first Democratic mayor in more than 20 years.
In Detroit, Mike Duggan became that city's first white mayor in 40 years. In Alabama's first congressional district, Republican Bradley Byrne defeated Tea Party candidate Dean Young in that congressional runoff. NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving is here. He has brought his teacup. And Ron, glance in. Give us an overarching first. Some analysts are pointing to the Tea Party losses in Virginia and Alabama as proof that voters are rejecting that wing of the GOP. Others are looking there and pointing to how close both races were as proof that the Tea Party is still strong. You say what?
Both sides have a point. The Tea Party did not get a win. That's really the bottom line. In politics, it doesn't matter if you lose by 5 or 10 points or if you lose by a bucket at the buzzer, you lost. And so the Tea Party did not get a win. They don't have a new champion. They don't have somebody they can point to as their new superstar. They would have loved to have made Ken Cuccinelli that person. They probably would have been happy with Dean Young, the guy in South Alabama that you mentioned a moment ago, who lost to Bradley Byrne, a more establishment Republican there in that congressional district around Mobile, Alabama. But look, we're down to talking about individual congressional districts here. And there really isn't a big national picture to be drawn from one congressional district, or really even from a couple of gubernatorial races.
Oh, interesting, because I know Jeremy is going to want to ask you about that. But let's stay with Virginia. Here's Terry McAuliffe, the Democrat, making his victory speech.
I know this has been a hard-fought race. Part of that, as you know, is the nature of politics. And part of it was that the Attorney General and I had some very big differences on some very important issues.
So very big differences between Terry McAuliffe and the Tea Party candidate, Ken Cuccinelli, but also other issues at work here. What was going on in this race?
Probably the biggest things that were going on were beyond the control of either of the candidates. Mm-hmm. The first thing was the government shutdown in October. That had been the dominant issue in this campaign in the month of October as we were walking up to the actual election day. And of course, in Northern Virginia in particular, the government shutdown was terribly unpopular. There are a lot of federal employees there, a lot of federal contractors there, many people who make their living off of those groups of people and from the federal government in general. They were unhappy enough with the sequester. It made them quite ready to vote for or against somebody, and the first opportunity they were going to have was this race. Then the government shutdown ended, and suddenly all the attention in the media, as you well know, shifted over to the problems of the Obamacare healthcare.gov website and the broken promise or apparent broken promise of the president saying everyone can keep their insurance if they're happy with it, and suddenly finding out that for some fraction of America, numbered in the millions of individuals, that's not going to be the case. So those were killer issues all of a sudden on the other side, and Ken Cuccinelli absolutely went all in on the Obamacare question. And legitimately on his part, he was one of the very first people in the country, the attorneys general, who went to court trying to block Obamacare, trying to stop it, suing, taking the case to the Supreme Court. He's really been there from day one, and he had every right to go after Obamacare in these last days. Now, of course, in the end, he does not, as governor of Virginia, have much control over that issue eventually, and neither does Terry McAuliffe have much control over government shutdowns, but they were the big issues, and those were the issues on which these two rose and fell.
You know, before we move on to New Jersey and with Jeremy, it was so interesting to watch that race because it was a reminder to politicians, don't gloat, because it was such a seesaw nature. You never know when the next anvil to fall out of the sky is going to be your issue.
You know, especially. Yes, especially when you're awaiting the results of some kind of a contest that's taking place outside of your control and jurisdiction.
That's right.
Ron, what about New Jersey? Let's listen first of all to Chris Christie, who, as we said, won in a landslide there. Here he is speaking last night.
I know that tonight a dispirited America, angry with their dysfunctional government in Washington, looks to New Jersey to say, is what I think happening really happening? Are people really coming together?
And I guess the big question here is what Chris Christie just did in New Jersey specific to his brand of politics in New Jersey, or is this what Republicans are going to be looking for as they look to 2016?
Yes, it is specific to his particular personality and his brand of politics and how his sort of tough-talking, big guy, Tony Soprano act came on at a very specific moment in New Jersey history and did very, very well, and at a time when the Democrats were really back on their heels, to put it nicely. And at that point, he also struck a magnificent sort of politician's bargain, if you will, with Barack Obama and Cory Booker. And Cory Booker, of course, went on to win the Senate seat in that state that possibly Chris Christie could have been interested in himself. And Chris Christie is free to pursue a re-election campaign as governor, whereby he gets elected with a 60% margin, and President Obama doesn't really exercise himself to find a candidate to run against Chris Christie. Oh, and yes, a year ago in that week after the Hurricane Sandy hit, and the president and the governor of New Jersey walked arm in arm down the damaged rows of houses. Fabulous imagery for both of them. All of this does not have to be spelled out in any sort of written way or even directly articulated way. It's a kind of implicit treaty, if you will, and it has worked very specifically for Chris Christie, and he thinks he can market it nationally, and that's why the speech he just gave could have just as easily doubled as a presidential campaign announcement speech.
Well, although there was a lot of analysis when Chris Christie put that special election for Cory Booker's seat where he did, that he didn't want Cory Booker to be on the ballot the same day as him because Booker would drive out a lot of Democratic support, and it might hurt Christie. It looks now, given the results, that he didn't really have anything to worry about.
No, but you know, it's funny about things like that. If you go back several months and you structure this thing entirely differently, then you have at the very least a sharing of the glory between Booker and Chris Christie on this one election night. That's at the very minimum. And that's if, of course, Cory Booker couldn't help propel some other Democratic candidate to a better showing. Let's face it, I mean, the Democratic candidate, a lovely woman, Barbara Buono from the state legislature, just got no real support from the National Party, no real financial support, no real backing. And, you know, it was scarcely even a competitive candidacy. So there was an understanding here. And again, I'm not implying anything that's underhanded or that isn't politics as usual. I'm just saying that it all has worked out very well for the governor, and that I think a lot of Democrats like to see him do well in this election so as to pose an alternative to the kind of Tea Party Republicanism they don't like.
Hey, Ron Elving, just one quick question about that in the brief time that we have. We mentioned the first congressional district race in Alabama. Bradley Byrne was very much supported by the business community, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, very conservative group. And, of course, he beat the Tea Party candidate. What? Just your thoughts on where the money was flowing in that race. Again, you say don't extrapolate from one district in Alabama, but is the business community in the Republican Party moving away from the Tea Party? Do you see something important there?
Yes, and the business community and the Tea Party are very much at loggerheads. We saw it in the government shutdown. We saw it in this particular race. We're going to see it again and again in 2014 and in 2016.
Well, thank you. That was brief. Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor. You can now drink your tea. Thanks so much.
Thank you both.
Well, there were some interesting results in Michigan last night. Detroiters elected Mike Dugan mayor. He will be the first white mayor of that city since the mid-70s. He got 55% of the vote. His opponent, Benny Napoleon, who is black, got 45%. Here is I said Dugan. It's Dugan. Here he is at his victory party.
If you live in this community, if you have your business in this community, we want all of your talents. You're all going to be equally valued and welcome, because only in that way will we rebuild the kind of Detroit everyone in this city deserves. God bless you and have a good night.
But we should remember that the city of Detroit is under the financial control of an emergency manager, Kevin Orr. So what does it really mean that this man, Mr. Dugan, is the new mayor of Detroit? Joining us now, Sarah Swick, Detroit reporter for Here and Now, contributor station, Michigan Radio. Sarah, how much power is he going to have?
Well, to start with, he's going to have very limited powers, to put it charitably. Kevin Orr is the emergency manager of the city of Detroit, basically has final authority over all major decisions, specifically budgetary ones. But it looks like Mike Duggan is going into this. He's going to start sort of building a platform, first of all, for when Kevin Orr leaves, which will probably be roughly about a year from now. And secondly, he on the operations side, Kevin Orr has had a little bit of trouble managing sort of both the finances of the city of Detroit. Obviously, the city is seeking Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection right now in federal court, and also the operations side, the sort of day-to-day management of the city. So it looks like that will sort of be more of Mike Duggan's focus initially to start with, but he has, realistically speaking, very little real power.
How significant is it that he's the first white mayor since the 70s? Detroit is overwhelmingly black.
I think it's significant, but I don't think that race, it just doesn't have the same sort of, I guess, powerful symbolism that it perhaps used to have. His opponent, Benny Napoleon, sort of subtly and not so subtly tried to make an issue out of it during the campaign, but it just didn't really seem to catch on too well. I mean, obviously, there are certain quarters of the city and certain people who I think remain suspicious of Duggan, not just because he's white, but because he didn't even live in the city of Detroit until a little over a year ago. And certain aspects of his pedigree, where he comes from as the former CEO of the Detroit Medical Center and his close ties to the business community, there is certainly some suspicion that he doesn't represent the needs and interests of what might be called, lifelong Detroiters, people who have lived in the city for a long time. But I think the race issue just didn't sort of grab a hold of people in the way that it might have in the past.
Sarah Swick from Michigan Radio. And Sarah, I have to ask you before we let you go, Ann Arbor, a 20-pound carp with a Twitter feed, was a write-in candidate for city council. Did the carp win?
Sadly, the carp made a showing, but he did not win.
Did not win. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I wanted the carp to win.
Well, so you don't live there, so you can't vote for him.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, offering a variety of insurance products, including auto, renters, boat, and motorcycle. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's Here and Now. Harvard recently announced the start of a new campaign to encourage more low-income students to apply to elite schools, which have been criticized for not doing enough to recruit gifted students of little means. In a minute, we'll hear from Harvard. But first, recent research shows that as many as 35,000 high-achieving, low-income students don't apply to top colleges, even though they have the grades. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, KUHF's Laura Eisensee reports on how Houston hopes to change that.
Edgar Avina is a senior with a 4.0 GPA at Houston's DeBakey High School. He's at a workshop reading the fifth draft of his college essay to a classmate. It's about why he works cutting grass.
I cut, ignoring my parched throat, which begs for hydration. I cut away at my uneasiness, forgetting this moment of toil, my father's state of health. I cut, trying to dig my mother out of a mound of hospital bills.
Edgar is 17 years old. His parents are immigrants from Mexico.
I have fended for my family, working outside endlessly, cutting through the thickets of life's hardships. In the eyes of my father, I am now a man.
At first, Edgar wanted to attend a regional college like Texas Tech. But after a trip out east, he changed his mind.
Then I saw these beautiful, picturesque schools, and I realized, hey, maybe I should consider these. And then I just fell in love with Yale.
Now, Edgar's dream school is Yale, where he hopes to study engineering. Students like Edgar should be strong candidates for top colleges, but according to recent research, they aren't.
It's still the case that your income and your background are strong predictors of where you end up in college.
Chris Avery is a professor of public policy at Harvard University. He and a professor from Stanford University, Caroline Hawksby, looked at where students from affluent families and students from low-income families, students with the same academic credentials, apply to college. They found that low-income students are much less likely to apply to the country's most selective schools. In fact, only 8% of high-achieving, low-income students act like their wealthier peers and apply to selective schools. And so they're missing out.
What's really at stake is not necessarily the prestige of going to, like, you know, a fancy, well-known selective college, but the fact that selective colleges tend to support their students better, they tend to have more resources, and students are more likely to graduate.
Avery says for these students, top colleges have so much financial aid to offer, they end up being cheaper than less competitive schools. But there's still a stereotype that top colleges are for rich kids. And Edgar says there's another, more personal reason students like him don't apply.
So many kids in Hispanic families aren't allowed to go out of state because families want to keep them close. I told my mom, I'm drawing a 500-mile circle and I want to get out of it.
Edgar is getting expert help with his college application from a new initiative in the Houston Independent School District. It's called Emerge. It's like private college consulting or Ivy League 101.
We have students at Harvard, at Tufts, at Dartmouth, at Oberlin, and MIT.
That's Rick Cruz, an assistant school superintendent in Houston. He started the Emerge program 3 years ago as a volunteer project. Students get SAT prep. They visit college campuses. They get one-on-one mentoring and lots of help with that all-important personal essay. And they're encouraged to reach for top schools with generous financial aid, schools like Yale. Rosalinda Garcia is an assistant dean of students there.
You know, it is competitive and it is expensive, but it's not expensive for everyone. These schools, Yale has so many resources that they're able to provide full aid to many families. I think the message hasn't trickled down.
For students like Edgar, going to a school like Yale isn't just about the prestige or getting an excellent education.
Like, my dream has always been, like, to retire my parents early so that they can live in this nice little house and then, like, you know, cuddle together on the porch swing or something. So, you know, I mean, that's what Yale would represent, like an opportunity to advance, lift your whole family up, basically.
If he makes it to Yale or any university, Edgar will be the first in his family to attend college. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
So, what are schools like Harvard doing to get that message out to students like Edgar? Harvard has long sent recruiters and search letters out to kids. And now through the new initiative, the Harvard College Connection, admissions officers and hopefully Harvard students will reach out on social media to get out the word that, first of all, because of recent drastic tuition changes, Harvard is free for families making under $65,000, and it can be only $15,000 a year for families making as much as $150,000. In fact, Harvard claims that for 90% of Americans, going to Harvard could be cheaper than going to many state schools. Williams Fitzsimmons is Harvard's Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid. So, Dean, why use social media?
We believe that by using social media and sort of a new campaign, not only can we get more students to come to Harvard from modest income backgrounds, but we also said that they should consider going to other Ivy institutions. They should go to other public and private institutions.
So you're trying to bridge this gap of understanding. In other words, getting the message out to these high-achieving high school seniors from the bottom quarter of the country's income distribution, that, in fact, they can afford to go to Harvard. But what about the criticism beyond getting that message out, that the way Harvard and other Ivy League schools consider students needs to change, that Harvard's admission office still uses legacy status in admission decisions? That means that students whose parents have not just gone to university but have attended Harvard have a leg up, that Harvard still uses the SAT, despite the data that suggests that SAT scores correlate strongly with family income. The more the family makes, the higher the scores. This is criticism from students in the Harvard Crimson. What do you think about that, about changing not just the outreach, but the way you look at prospective students?
Well, we're fully aware of this, and in many respects, I've lived it. I grew up 15 miles south of Boston. My parents hadn't gone to college. The high school I attended, and I remember this was the old days, didn't like Harvard at all. In fact, the first two teachers I asked to write recommendations wouldn't do it because they said Harvard was a bunch of communists, a bunch of atheists, a bunch of rich snobs, that if you it was anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic, that if you went there, you would flunk out and you would lose your soul. But one of the things I looked at immediately was, at that point and now, Harvard typically has the highest graduation rate in the country.
It sounds as if one of the things that maybe your office still has to address is almost a culture war, a sense on the part of high-achieving kids from lower-income families that Harvard may not want them.
You have actually, you've hit on the nub of one of our biggest problems. Now that we have close to 70% actually of our students on some kind of financial aid here, you know, a quarter of the students now are $80,000 and under. This is a different Harvard. What we need to do is to connect these students that we have here now who are living the experience with other students out there. We'd love to have them come to Harvard. We'd love to have them go to college.
William Fitzsimmons, Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid at Harvard, talking about the school's new initiative, the Harvard College Connection. Dean Fitzsimmons, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
So to learn more, go to hereandnow.org. By the way, quick heads up, tomorrow on Here and Now, author Joseph Finder knows his conspiracy theories. That's what he writes about in his novels. But he says if you read the newly reissued Marina and Lee, you will know that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Reputation.com, providing tools for measuring, repairing, and protecting the reputations of professionals and businesses on the Internet. Reputation.com. And Lumosity.com, dedicated to improving memory and attention with neuroscience-based games for the brain at Lumosity.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Last night, New Jersey voters reelected their governor, Chris Christie, but they also overwhelmingly approved a $1 hike in the state's minimum wage. Starting in January, the minimum wage in New Jersey will be $8.25 an hour. Nationwide, the federal minimum wage has been $7.25 an hour since 2009. Now, President Obama has asked Congress to raise that again, but so far, lawmakers have not made that happen. So more and more states are taking action on their own. Joining us now to talk about all this is Marilyn Giewax, senior business editor with NPR. Marilyn, good to have you back. And tell us about what happened last night, because it wasn't just New Jersey.
Right. First, in New Jersey, it really was a slam dunk. Voters overwhelmingly approved this wage hike, and now it joins New York, where the state legislature already had approved a wage hike. So we're seeing, you know, real momentum as far as states approving this. But the big thing that, you know, it's kind of a small town, SeaTac, Washington, that's where the surprise was. People appear to have passed by a fairly good margin and increased to $15 an hour. That's a lot of money. But it only applies to people who work in or around Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. So, you know, that's a relatively small group of people. But still, when you think about it, it's not just mechanics or pilots or airport workers like that. It's the people who make sandwiches, who are the janitors, whatever. Everyone across the board will be able to make $15 an hour now. And that's pretty amazing, more than double the federal wage.
So if there is this support for this around the country, why hasn't Congress raised the federal minimum wage?
That's interesting. The federal wage was last raised in July of 2009. It's been at this $7.25 for a long time now. And President Obama, at the start of the year during his State of the Union address, said he wanted to raise the rate to $9 an hour. But it always has a lot of resistance in Congress because, you know, if you think about it, every single member of Congress has at least one restaurant in their district, often lots and lots of restaurants. And the restaurant owners are really opposed to higher wages, as well as the small business owners. So the lawmakers get a lot of lobbying. They hear a lot about it when they go back to their districts from the small business people. So there's a lot of resistance at a federal level to raising these federal minimum wage. But as we said, you know, on the state and city level, the voters are going around the lawmakers and just taking these direct ballot initiatives.
Well, yeah, and the argument against it always, it comes from these business leaders who would say if you raise the minimum wage, you're going to have fewer jobs created as a result of that. What does the economic research show about the impact of raising the wage?
Well, the wage has been set for 75 years now, so there's been a lot of time to look at the economic impact of it. And most studies actually show that the impact on total employment is pretty marginal. You know, in any specific business, if suddenly you have to pay more in wages, you may not be able to hire another worker, or right, you may have to let someone go. But overall, if consumers have more money in their pocket, you know, a lot of those low-wage workers, as soon as they get some more money, they can, you know, get a haircut, buy a pizza, whatever. Yep. They help stimulate the economy so that overall, in the aggregate, you end up with somewhat, you know, breaking even, where you have jobs shift, but they're not necessarily shrinking.
Marilyn Giewax, NPR Senior Business Editor, thank you as always.
Oh, it's good to be with you, Jeremy.
And let us know what you think. Does the minimum wage need to go up across the country? Should it be more than $7.25 an hour? You can go to hereandnow.org and weigh in with your thoughts. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. It's Here and Now. After rescuing a damsel in distress from the cable car tracks in San Francisco's Nob Hill, then capturing the Riddler in the act of robbing a downtown vault, he will get a call on his bat phone and go to the window, where he will look down and see a huge group of people jumping up and down and calling for Batman to help. And he will be Batman, or Batboy. He is 5-year-old Miles. He's fighting leukemia, and on Friday, November 15th, the San Francisco Make-A-Wish Foundation will grant Miles his wish, helping him live out his fantasy of being Bat Kid. They're going to transform San Francisco into Gotham City for a day. They've got a Batmobile to transport Bat Kid from crisis to scripted and acted-out crisis. They've got the Penguin, the Riddler, and they've had thousands of people respond to their call for help, many calling with a lump in their throat. Patricia Wilson is executive director of the San Francisco chapter of Make-A-Wish Foundation. She joins us on the line. And so, Patricia, you asked volunteers to help Miles' wish come true. Give us an idea of what the response has been like.
My phone's going to explode. You know, it was just unbelievable, the response that we're getting, and it warms my heart how compassionate people are, and the calls coming from all over. The story's big in Norway right now, apparently. And we have people flying in for this, to experience this. So it is
Wait. People are flying into San Francisco?
Yes, people are taking their kids out of school so they experience it. I have people who are flying in. Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Well, what are some of the things that people are volunteering to do?
We've had everything from a grilled cheese sandwich for Miles. Someone made custom shoes. Now he has Bat Kid shoes. This has just really struck a nerve, I think. And it's a rare public wish. Most of our wishes are very private and intimate, and this one is one in which we needed people to assist, and people are rising. And there really isn't a better city for this. I don't think that this kind of response would happen in any other major market. San Francisco is known for heart and soul and people coming out, and my goodness, this is demonstrating that.
Well, they certainly are. And you mentioned most wishes are private. Let's explain what the Make-A-Wish Foundation is for some people who might not know. It's children who are wrestling with terrible illnesses and situations who literally ask you to fulfill a wish. What are some of the wishes that are usually fulfilled?
There's 5 wish types. I wish to be, I wish to go, obviously, to Disney or to see their family. I wish to meet a celebrity. I wish to have, often, a laptop computer or a backyard playset, because our kids have compromised immune systems, so they can't play at the park, so something in their own backyard is special. And the last wish is I wish to help children who use their wish to make the world a better place.
Oh, boy. Well, and here, we don't know Miles' last name, but he's 5, and we see this little picture of him in this little bat outfit, like a Halloween costume. What was his wish?
His wish is to be Batman. And when I worked with the family back in the spring, we've been working on this for a while, one of the options was turning San Francisco into Gotham City, and that's the one that resonated. So off we went.
Sure, why not? Well, as it turns out, yeah, the police chief and the mayor are going to greet Miles at the end of his day and present him with the key to the city for having saved it.
Well, the police chief is doing more than that.
Okay.
I mean, he's actually doing the breaking news story early in the day asking if anyone knows the whereabouts of Batman because he needs help fighting crime in the city of San Francisco. And he's going to be the one all day long giving Miles instructions where he's going.
Ah, well, I understand at one point there's going to be like a fake accident on the corner so he can rescue people.
I can't tell all the secrets, but yes, we've got it all planned out here, we think. And we're going to present some opportunities for him to be a real superhero. And you know the real story here, though? I think any child battling cancer really is a superhero. And this is just so sweet that we get to do something amazing and get people excited about our little superhero. We have people who are, I'm watching Twitter and people are showing up in their Batman gear and they're going to wear black and yellow that day. And it's just, you know, it's Miles' day. And how special is that, that he gets a great day after the battle he's had. And by the way, he's doing great. He's out of the worst part of his treatment for leukemia and he's feeling strong, which is one of the reasons why we waited to schedule this wish now, so that he'd have the energy to not need a nap.
Yeah. Well, but if Batman, Batkid, needs a nap on November 15th, darn it, the whole city will pause while he has one.
I think so.
But so I'm seeing, for instance, he's going to get a call on his bat phone and he's going to go to a window and he'll look down. There'll be a huge group of volunteers jumping up and down and calling for his help because the Penguin is going to be kidnapping a famous mascot. But who are those people, for instance, who are going to, how many people are going to be jumping up and down there?
We understand that a lot of people have expressed interest. So it's my cousin is organizing the flash mob.
Because,
you know, you got to have a flash mob. And so it's going to be on Union Square. And I think there'll be a few hundred people down there at that point. And I don't know who's showing up on City Hall, but I let the police know that I think it's going to be big.
I have one little thought. If people do show up in, like, the Riddler outfit, like, Miles might go after them.
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, because what we've got planned is we have an adult Batman, who, by the way, is a friend of mine. He's a former stunt double. So Miles has a buddy, so he's going to be doing whatever adult Batman wants him to do.
Oh, and so you're going to have a stunt double who might actually do things like...
Oh, yeah. No, I have an acrobatic coach. I've got pyrotechnics. The real Adam West is called and is coming. I mean, someone offered a drone to drop things out of the sky. We're just laughing. I mean, now it's just funny.
You know, it sounds wonderful. If you are in San Francisco on November 15th and you see a convertible sprinting away from the scene of a crime, in it will be Batkid after catching the Penguin on his way to City Hall. Just really quite something. And Patricia, I'm guessing that you hope that these people who are responding, coming from around the world for Miles, might check out some of the other wishes.
Oh, absolutely. And we love them to be part of Gotham City for this one, so come and join us. But if you can't, watch on Twitter and Facebook, because we are going to unveil this wish in real time for everyone who can't be there. And then check out every other one. There's so many amazing stories. My chapter alone, we're fulfilling over 300 wishes a year, and every one is an extraordinary story.
Patricia Wilson, Executive Director of Make-A-Wish Greater Bay Area. On November 15th, they, along with thousands of volunteers, are going to turn San Francisco into Gotham City for five-year-old Miles. Patricia, thanks so much.
My goodness, thank you.
And Robin, we've got a link to the Make-A-Wish Foundation for the Bay Area at hereandnow.org. I'm just looking at some of the other wishes here. A four-year-old who wishes to be a fisherman, another four-year-old who wants to go to Disney World, and a three-year-old who is just wishing for a train-themed play structure.
Yeah, so check out your Make-A-Wish Foundation in your area. And by all means, you're going to be in San Francisco. You know what you got to do on November 15th. You're listening to Here Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
It's Here and Now. Several big cities elected mayors yesterday.
But make no mistake, the people of this city have chosen a progressive path.
than Boston. I promise you, the best is yet to come.
I want to thank, most importantly, the voters of Houston. Our voters are dedicated to making Houston an even better place to live, to work, and to raise a family.
That was Houston's reelected mayor, Anise Parker. Before that, Boston's new mayor, Marty Walsh, and New York City's new mayor, Bill de Blasio. And pay attention to them, because our next guest says cities are becoming more important than ever. Lee Gallagher is assistant managing editor of Fortune. Her new book is called The End of the Suburbs, Where the American Dream is Moving. Lee Gallagher joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, is it really the end of the suburbs? Because I have to say, when I drive out into the suburbs, they seem like they're thriving and booming and getting bigger every day.
You know, it's the end of the suburbs as we've come to know them. You know, the suburbs really have evolved over the years from these sort of small village-oriented communities to these sprawling subdivisions that are kind of supersized and Stepfordized, and many of them are in the middle of nowhere. And that's the kind of suburb that is no longer satisfying to a lot of people and is going to be a smaller part of our overall residential environment.
Did the housing collapse several years ago make a real dent in the suburbs? Have we seen something significant happen in the last 5 years?
We did, for sure. The housing crisis affected the suburbs because most of our houses in this country are suburban houses. So that's where we felt the brunt of the overexpansion, the overbuilding, and that's where we felt the brunt of the pain. But the truth is, and I say this in the book, many of the forces that are leading to the end of the suburbs are actually longer-term, slower-moving forces that have really been grinding away for quite some time.
We'll talk about some of those. What are the main forces that are leading to the end of the suburbs?
The biggest ones, I will say, are the price of energy, which has been rising ever since the suburbs were created and is making these long commutes really unaffordable for a lot of people. It's also things like demographics, which people don't really give a lot of thought to, but the makeup and the fabric of our nation is changing. We used to be a country of households of, you know, a mother, father, 2.5 children, a couple cars, and that's really declining. Our birth rate's declining. We're getting married later. Single-person households are the fastest-growing household in this country. So all of these changes mean that that nuclear family is going to represent a smaller percentage of the overall mix, and we're already seeing that in some suburbs, which have more senior citizens and baby boomers in them than families with young children.
And you write, millennials hate the burbs.
That's another huge thing. I mean, that's, you know, millennials are the next generation of home buyer, and all evidence shows that they really want to be close to where the action is. And that can be in a kind of urban burb, the right urban burb, but they want to be somewhere where they can walk to things, where they can be on their devices and texting and not being behind the wheel of a car for, you know, half hour, hours at a time.
But can the suburbs really go away, or at least shrink down, while we still have policies in place like the mortgage interest tax deduction, which incentivizes home buying, or like putting money into highways and expanding highways all around this country, making it easy for people to get back and forth from the city to the suburb and vice versa?
Our policies have definitely pushed us into a suburban residential pattern. There's no doubt about it. Another thing that people don't realize is even the price of gas is highly subsidized. You know, we don't pay nearly the cost that other countries pay because there's so much subsidies that go into keeping the cost of our gas per gallon low. So those policies are all pushing us towards suburban living, but the demographics and the changing preferences of people are really starting to move in the other direction. We're seeing a greater demand for houses in communities where there's more of a centralized urban downtown. Yes, more people are moving into cities, and that's part of it, especially young families are moving into cities and staying in cities. You never used to see that. But the future is also about kind of urban burbs, suburbs that can adapt and kind of get with these times and reorient themselves along the lines such that they'll be offering things that the homebuyer wants.
Well, and of course, one of the big reasons that people have wanted to go to the suburbs traditionally is that it is considered a safer place. You have more space. And you write that maybe that's not so much the case anymore.
Not so much anymore. I really found a number of reversals happening. And it's everything from where the wealth is moving and all of these moneyed people moving into cities now, corporate headquarters moving into cities. But another reversal that people, I think, never thought would really happen is that poverty and crime are now dropping in cities fairly sharply and rising in the suburbs, especially poverty. It's been one of the more striking trends of the last decade is the rise of poverty in suburban America.
You talk about some of the social implications of the fact that many people have grown up in the suburbs, starting with the fact that young people have to be chauffeured around by their parents. They don't have the kind of freedom that they would have if they lived in a city.
The suburban model can be isolating for a lot of people, even though you think of suburbs as these tight communities, and many are. But the more remote, sprawling kind of suburban communities, you know, where you're really in your car all the time, that means that until you're 16 or 17 years old and you can drive, you're completely at the mercy of your parents driving you around, which, you know, adolescent psychologists say that this is precisely the time when teenagers need to develop and preteens need to develop autonomy, which is a very important trait. So, you know, you kind of can't do that. And when you also can't go outside and just walk around in many of these communities because there's no sidewalks and the design doesn't really encourage that kind of playing in the street or running around outside the way older suburbs do, you can see why so many kids are inside playing video games in the basement.
Now, I grew up in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, which is not a suburb or a city. It's a college town. And as a result, it's very different than other places. And actually, when I saw the movie American Beauty, which is a very suburban movie, I didn't even really get it at first because I hadn't lived in a suburb. It was only after I had lived in Bethesda, Maryland, which is about as suburban as you can get, that I really understood the movie. You grew up in Media, Pennsylvania. Tell us about your experience there.
It's funny. I take great pains to point out that I grew up in the suburbs. I'm a child of suburbia. I don't have anything against it. People may not believe that, but I don't. I had a wonderful experience, and that's because I grew up in a town that was really kind of unique, or it's unique now. It's a suburb about 12 miles southwest of Philadelphia, and it has all these ingredients that you don't really see in suburbs anymore. It has a courthouse. It's the county seat of our county. It has a trolley. It has a lively, densely packed main street that has bars that are open until 2 in the morning. And it has all of this kind of built-in, natural, organic community. And we were close to the town. We could walk to it. But I also grew up in this little community where we had a 4th of July party every year. We had Christmas caroling on, you know, around the holidays. I mean, it was very, you know, Grover's Corners almost. Mm. But that kind of suburb and that kind of community is not how most people in this country live anymore. And so that's the point I'm really trying to make in the book. I mean, I think we're spoiled here in the Northeast because, I mean, in Boston, there's so many older historic suburbs that are built on this older model and that still have many of the things that people are now so desperately missing in their communities. But, you know, most Americans live in communities that were built in the last 50 years. And you look at places like the Inland Empire, Southern California. You know, these places are just centerless communities, and that's because they were built that way, and it's really impacting people in the way they live.
And as you write, it sounds like people are not that interested in those kinds of communities.
Increasingly, not so much. They want the old kind. They want the better kind. They want the urban kind, even if that's in a suburb. Not everybody wants to live in a skyscraper in Manhattan, that's for sure.
Lee Gallagher is assistant managing editor at Fortune and author of The End of the Suburbs, Where the American Dream is Moving. Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
I've seen those big machines come rolling through the quiet pines. Bankers with their Volvos and their Valentines.
And you can read excerpts from Lee's book at hereandnow.org and let us know if you think the suburbs are coming to an end. From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from the Institute of Contemporary Art with Amy Silman, a 25-year retrospective of the artist's vivid abstract paintings and intimate drawings, ICABoston.org.